when I'm discussing violence, I want to talk specifically about a particular kind of violence, war, which is Cicero calls war contention by force. It's the interesting recent philosopher Alexander Mosley calls war a collective, open-ended violence. So we're not talking about individual acts of violence. Say someone doesn't like my lecture and knocks me down. We have mind warfare. And I want to distinguish three different views that we find in the philosophical tradition of war. One is that war is desirable or has a lot of beneficial aspects to it. This is, I'm going to talk probably the most about this view because it's one I think most people are unfamiliar with. And the second is that war is something that should be subject to legal or moral regulation. This has a suggestion that war is in some respects undesirable, although it doesn't logically require that. Somebody could hold war is a very good thing, but we should just have a lot of moral, or at least some moral or legal regulations. But in the last view is that war is undesirable and to be avoided. Now the first of these views is one we find that the war is desirable, has a lot of good aspects to it. It's one we find in Greek philosophy very much. I want to, if we look, for example, at Plato, I want to concentrate not so much on his most famous work of political philosophy, The Republic, because in that one, it's not clear how much Plato intended the scheme describing the Republic to be put in practice. He describes it at one point as a politics laid up in the heavens. It might just be kind of a utopian ideas he had. It's unclear whether he wanted this put in practice. But if we look at his last dialogue, The Laws, which he calls the second best regime, the regime that can actually be put into practice, we see it's a very different kind of government from the one we're most used to. What we think of today is we think the government is something very distinct from our private lives. Each of us has his or her own private life, and we have various religious or philosophical opinions. But the government is really something that's either performing, at least supposed to perform, certain services for us. It's giving us protection or providing certain economic services for us. At least this is the official rationale. But we wouldn't have the idea today, except we did have this in the communist countries or in the fascist government. We wouldn't have the idea today that the government is supposed to tell us what to think, or that everyone has to think the same things, or that we all have to share exactly the same beliefs to be in the society. But Plato in The Laws held exactly this view. He said that there should be everyone really has to hold the same beliefs. And in fact, it was a common belief in Greek society that the gods that people believed in were the gods of a specific city they lived in. You could have cities with the same gods. You would have, say, Zeus would be the god of a whole lot of different cities, but they would have special names for the god that was specific to that specific city. So that your religious belief was very closely connected with where you lived. You couldn't say, well, I'm a resident of Athens, but I hold different religious views from the rest of the Athenians. It would be very difficult for you. If you did say that, everyone would have to really believe the same thing. And the 19th century French historian Fustel de Coulanges, in a famous book, The Ancient City, stressed very much how the Greeks had this view. The city is really what people really believed, and the gods were so closely connected with the city, they really had a belief in the city as some kind of collective entity that they were all parts of. Now, Plato said also there should be what he called a nocturnal council, which was kind of an inquisition that would find out if people had deviant beliefs and then subject them to re-education if they didn't hold the proper beliefs. If this didn't work, then the people would be eliminated. All right, now, the way this is related to war is this, that Plato and those who think in this way thought that there are specific virtues that are found in warfare. For example, soldiers have to display courage in war. They're risking their own lives in battle. And you don't have in peacetime the opportunity to display this kind of courage very often. Sometimes you do, say, rescuing people from danger. But in war, you're able to display your courage in a way not very easy to find in peacetime. And also, you can display other virtues. For example, you can sacrifice yourself for other people who are in battle with you, or you can sacrifice yourself for the city. And this was one of the supreme virtues in this Greek conception. Remember, for example, when Socrates is condemned to death and he's given a chance to escape, he says he doesn't want to escape because he owes everything to the city. He can't leave Athens because this is where he owes everything to the city. So you see, you have this idea that by sacrificing yourself for the city, you're displaying a supreme form of virtue, and this is something to be that you're not able to attain in peacetime. Now, a model that Plato used for this, but he was very he was very sympathetic to the type of government found in the city-state of Sparta, which is one where, as you no doubt know, that military virtue was stressed the most. It doesn't by any means follow from this that a state or city-state organized on Platonic lines or following Plato's principles would always be very aggressive or always be engaged in war, but it would just be that war has certain virtues in it that we would not find in peacetime, and this is a very desirable thing, according to Plato, that we would have these virtues. And he had a very low view of economic activities. This was kind of, we had to have certain kinds of trading and economic activities, but this was something that was very much a bad part of life, or a sort of a distasteful necessity that not to be compared with the real virtues that are found in the military activities. That this is where you could really, at least for, there were a few people who were capable of something even higher, which is philosophical contemplation, but for most people, the highest type of virtue they could find is in military activity. I think one very good source here, although I think there's severe problems for the interpretation of Plato that's generally given by the scholars, in Karl Popper's book, Open Society and Its Enemies, first volume of that, has a good account of the influence of Sparta on Plato's thought, although I wouldn't recommend the whole book for its whole interpretation of Plato, but I think on this point he's right. So we have this, again, this notion that war is sometimes desirable. Now, from my point of view, unfortunately, this notion didn't die out with Plato and the Greek philosophers. You find it, it's a constant theme in later writers. For example, Machiavelli criticizes Christianity, and he says, well, the Christians have the notion of salvation as something apart from the state, that salvation is a relationship between the individual and God. And this is a very, according to him, what happens if you have this idea that you're salvation is something that depends on a personal relationship between you and God, then isn't this going to weaken the city or the state, that people aren't devoting their whole lives to the state? And he thought this was very undesirable. He thought that Christianity had made the states that adopted it too peaceful, and he thought that something should be done about this, although it's not clear what he wanted to do about it. We find more explicitly the 18th century philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau has the notion of, again, criticizes Christianity on grounds that are very similar to Machiavelli, which is not surprising because he read Machiavelli and was very influenced by him. So he said, we have to, again, Christianity is really at fault because it separates the individual from the state. We have to have a new civil religion that will require everybody to have certain common beliefs where they're all subordinating themselves to the state. Everyone is to be subordinated to the state. You don't have the right to be an individual apart from the state, but you really gain your whole being by some sort of collective, being part of the general will, being part of the collective. Now, you find, interestingly enough, these notions, that's to say, of militant, certain that everyone is part of the state, and that one of the ways we display virtue, one of the principal ways we display virtue is by military activities in warfare. We're able to decide our being part of the city and are being willing to sacrifice ourselves for the city. We find this today in this school of thought, in the so-called Straussian school of thought. I want to say a bit about that because it's been claimed that this is very influential in contemporary American foreign policy. One sometimes seems to claim that Paul Wolfowitz, who's a very high official in the Defense Department, was a student of Leo Strauss, although it's been disputed how close he studied with Strauss. And then there are various claims. William Kristol, who was a leading defender of the invasion of Iraq, was very influenced by Strauss. So there are various claims as to how influential Strauss has been on American foreign policy. And some people said, well, no, he wasn't very influential at all. He was a historian of political thought. He didn't really have very strong political views of his own. But I do think that there are certainly students of his who profess themselves to be Straussians, like Karnes Lord, who was an official of the Reagan administration, or Harvey Mansfield, who's a professor of government at Harvard, who call themselves Straussians, who take views that are very much along the lines that I've just suggested, this Platonic view that war has very desirable aspects, at least in some respects, and that people have to be unified in certain common beliefs. I want to take an example, a book that came out a couple years ago, just before the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center. It was called Making Patriots by Walter Burns. Burns was a professor for a long time at Cornell University, a very influential follower of Leo Strauss. And what Burns says, and we can see these views I was just talking about are not really old-fashioned views, but people are still holding them today. He says, we need to have a common civic religion. It isn't that people, he says, in the, again, making a point I've just made earlier, he says, in the Greek city-states, we had everybody believing the same thing according to what the gods of the city were. He said, we don't have that anymore because of Judaism and Christianity. We have the notion of belief as something that's private, that people have apart from the city. He said, well, we can't really change that. He seems to suggest it would be desirable we could change that. There's nothing we can really do about that now. But he says, well, what we have to do is have a common civic religion, and this civic religion is to be based on the principally on the speeches and activities of Abraham Lincoln. I'm sure Tom DiLorenzo will be very happy to hear this. So he says, particularly the Gettysburg Address is the greatest speech ever written, and we should really have this and all teach this as get all this. Everyone to learn this, and we could all absorb Lincoln's wisdom. And when we do this, we'll realize that what the supreme goal, at least in political life, is that we'll be able to sacrifice ourselves for the state in warfare. So, and we have exactly the same ideas as I mentioned. Plato is still very prominent today, that the notion we're sacrificing ourselves for the state is part of a civic religion. I want to mention this Platonic view isn't the only view that holds that war is desirable. Of course, we could mention other philosophers who've held this view. For example, Hegel, at least in his early writings, has very much the same view that we, in war, people are able to attain certain kinds of unity that they're unable to have otherwise, and this is a very good thing, in that he mentions in his great early work, Phenomenology, he criticizes Christianity. He says this led to the notion of the unhappy consciousness where the individual is separate from society, but if we're engaged in the collective activities, one of which is war, then we can attain meaning in a way we can't other than individual life. Now, there's a related view that holds that war is undesirable. We find in other philosophers, for example, we find, I'll mention specifically the early 20th century German philosopher and sociologist Georg Simmel, who, I think he wasn't that bad. But he did have unusual views. And what he held was that our ordinary life is very complicated. We have, say, in modern economic production, which he was very interested in. He wrote a book called Philosophy of Money, which some Austrians think has certain Austrian insights. He says it's very complicated. We have long chains of means and ends. Say, to produce something requires long chains of production. We can have various accounts of structured production. They're very hard for people to follow. So he says life gets very complicated for people. People get very cynical about things because they can't follow what's going on. He said we need to have, to remedy this, we need to have kind of very heightened sensations. We need to really experience things directly. And what better way to do this than to have a war than we can really experience things in a very direct way. We'll have a whole lot of different sensations from the ones we usually do, and this will give us meaning in life, that by having all these new aesthetic sensations, that so we won't we'll be able to attain meaning in a way that we didn't have before. We find similar ideas in the early 20th century French writer Georges Sorel, who had a famous essay, short book called Reflections on Violence. And he said that in modern life, people are dominated too much by rational thought. People are trying to reason things out. But we have to really, this is separating us from what's really important in life. And by direct action, by violence, then we can attain real meaning. There's a very interesting discussion by that came out in a book last year by the writer Chris Hedges, who had a book called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. He's not very sympathetic to this idea that war is a good thing because it provides us with these sensations or experiences we don't have in ordinary life, but he discusses this view at length, and he says he was a war correspondent. He's very attracted to this view. He sees the force of it. He thinks it's something very dangerous because of all the horrible things that happen in war, but he thinks this is something that we need to take on. But he thinks this is why people actually engage in wars, because they're seeking this kind of special experiences. They think they'll get meaning in their life from the extreme situations that they won't get in their ordinary life. So, as I say, this is the first of the three types of three traditions I want to talk about. As I say, it's one that probably most people are not too familiar with. Now, the second one I want to mention is the notion that war should be subject to certain kinds of legal or moral regulation. This is one we find especially developing in the Middle Ages. Now, what we had, of course, there were various, we had, just as now, we had various nations that sometimes came into conflict with each other. We had the notion, there was a notion in the Middle Ages that all the Christian countries were part of a single entity, which is called the Christian Republic, the Res Publica Christiana. So they were all, in a sense, part of a common realm. And because they were part of a common realm, they should be limited. They should limit the violence they would inflict on each other. Now, I should mention the Res Publica Christiana, the Christian Republic, an entirely different notion from the Holy Roman Empire. In a book that came out a few years ago by Harry Jaffa, who you may know is not one of my favorite authors, he apparently confuses it because he says at one point he puts England in the Holy Roman Empire. Seemed like a rather strange... I wondered in my review when exactly was England part of the Holy Roman Empire. I'd like to have the dates on that. It is true that England was at one time a papal fief when the Pope annulled the Magna Carta, but I don't think it was ever part of the Holy Roman Empire. That's just a digression. I like to always attack Jaffa when I can. We had the notion that because all the nations were part of the Christian Republic, then they should limit the violence they would direct against each other. And the limitations on the power on war that were developed, say, by many of the great Christian thinkers like St. Augustine, Thomas Aquinas, and they were developed later by some of the Spanish scholastics like De Vitoria and later by Hugo Grotius and others, they generally had very severe restrictions. These kinds of restrictions were both on when you could engage in war at all, what were the conditions in which you would be able to engage in a just war, and also once you were in the war, there were certain limits on what you could do, even if you passed the test, you were in a just war, you couldn't do anything you wanted. You had to observe certain limits. For example, one of the restrictions that you find in Aquinas is that war has to be a last resort. You have to have tried peaceful means of settlement first. For example, we can see one case where this, I think, seems to have been violated in the U.S. Invasion of Afghanistan. There were certain negotiations that seemed to be taking place between the U.S. and the Taliban forces in control in Afghanistan. Then the U.S. said, well, they're not really sincere in this, so they're going to invade anyway. They're going to disregard this. But according to the classical just war theory, you're not allowed to do this. You have to pursue these measures of negotiation till it's evident that they failed. You can't just say, well, I'm not going to bother with that because it's interfering with what I want to do. There's a recent writer, Jean Bethke Elstein, who's at the University of Chicago, who has a rather truncated view of natural law. And she says, well, of course, last resort doesn't really apply if it's going to get in the way of your military tactics, but that's not really what the people had in mind by natural law restriction. And just an example of what's meant by restriction on what's done in war, one of the principal rules of the just war tradition is that you can't directly intend the death of people who aren't fighting. You can't say, well, it would really... get the enemy very upset if we just destroyed one of their large civilian centers of population and they'd really see reason and surrender. According to just war theory, you can't do that. Even if you're right that would have just the effect you want, you can't say, well, this is the way I can bring the war to an end in as soon a way as possible, so I'm just going to attack the civilians. That'll just minimize total casualties, so it's a good thing to do. This would be a violation of standard just war principles. Now, we can see this whole notion has been very influential later on. For example, Immanuel Kant had the notion of a universal system of republics, each of which would be peaceful. He thought by having not a world government, kind of a league of all the different republican governments, we would have a peaceful world. But I think we can see one danger in this type of thought, which was called attention to, I think, probably best by the great German constitutional theorist, an extremely controversial writer, Carl Schmitt, in his book, many books that he wrote in the 20th century, especially a book called The Nomos of the Earth, which is on the, what he called the public law of Europe. What he pointed out is, he said, well, there's a danger in this notion of legal moral regulation, because then we can start to view international affairs as if they were to be equated with local police matters. We would say, just say, suppose we have somebody say someone robs you, you would say, well, that's the criminal, then the police have to capture that person. It wouldn't make sense to say somebody's neutral between the robber and the police. So he says, Schmitt says, well, if you apply this notion of legal regulation to international affairs too far, then you'll say, well, there's certain aggressor nations who are just criminals, and then the rest of the countries have to come in and suppress them. And this is going to lead to many more wars than before, and we won't be able to limit wars by negotiation because, sorry, I can't take any calls right now. I guess the person's pretty persistent, keeps calling back. We have to limit the, so he says, well, we'll have a notion these aggressors are criminal and have to be, we can't have any neutrals. And anyone who tries to be neutral is just someone who favors aggression. He says this is going to lead to more and more wars, and it's not going to produce a peaceful world as the proponents of that view held. So it's sort of really what we had, what Schmitt was criticizing, was not the tradition of just war thinking, which he to some extent supported, although he had his own very peculiar take on natural law. But he said this has been really perverted by certain 20th century writers, say, and politicians such as Woodrow Wilson, into a new type of interventionism. So now, in the short time remaining, I just want to mention what I think is the, I've left very little time for it because I think this is a view I'm sure you're all familiar with, the view of war as undesirable, which we find especially in the classical liberal tradition. And we find, for example, in Herbert Spencer, in the German sociologist Franz Oppenheimer, said that they distinguish very sharply between two different methods of people can attain their end. One is peaceful production exchange, where Oppenheimer called this the economic means, where people can attain their ends by cooperation, by having a system of social cooperation. We can each get much more than we could attain by individual actions. If each person were producing by himself, there'd be very few people would be able to be living. But by being in an organized society where we're peacefully exchanging goods and services with each other, we can attain much more, almost infinitely more than we could by individual action. And this is in this type of action takes place only if it's to everyone's mutual benefit, because of course you wouldn't engage in an exchange if it's not to your benefit. So whenever you have an exchange, it's the mutual benefit of everyone engaged in it. This is contrasted with the political means where one person is taking, or a group of people is taking something from another. And of course, this is what we find in warfare. So the notion here was that war is something that's very undesirable because it's interfering with the whole process of social cooperation. And we can see, I think perhaps the best account of this whole system is in Mises' Human Action. We have the whole notion of what Mises called the law of association, the notion that we can have peaceful relations, people enabling each one to attain his ends, is something that's really perhaps the basic theme of Mises' book, Human Action. I think we can see in this especially we can by combining this notion, war is undesirable, with certain aspects of the just war tradition, we can get, I think, a really good account of the proper views on war, so that we see that from this, war is something that's to be engaged in almost never, perhaps only in case of direct invasion, because it interferes with the whole process of social cooperation. Well, I think I'm about out of time now. Thanks.